Political scientists in our time like to talk about the rise of a Christian right in America as if it's a recent thing. And in politics, it may be relatively recent, but the rise of fundamentalist Christianity in America goes back about a century and a half, with roots in the Civil War, among other events. Decades of people interpreted the events of our time as signs that the end times were coming in biblical prophecy. Matthew Avery Sutton chronicles the rise of the movement in his book, American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. Matthew Sutton is the Edward R. Meyer Distinguished Professor of History at Washington State University. He teaches courses in 20th century United States history, cultural history, and religious history. So never a dull moment, Matthew Sutton, I'm thinking.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Jeffrey.
Sure. You cite earlier historians who pushed academics to take fundamentalism seriously. What was the general range of thinking about fundamentalism as it began to rise in America?
Well, there was a sense that it was going to be a short-lived experiment, that, you know, beginning with the real public awareness of fundamentalism in the 1920s and 1930s, secular critics, scholars, journalists, everybody sort of thought this was kind of a rural, ignorant, southern phenomenon that would have a short shelf life and then disappear. And so it really took people by surprise when we see the rise of the religious right in the late 1970s and the coming of Jerry Falwell and other political leaders who then helped influence Ronald Reagan. And so ever since then, scholars have been scrambling to sort of catch up, to try to understand who these folks were who have actually been relatively powerful and relatively influential for the course of the entire 20th century, but for the most part under the radar, at least until the last 20 or 30 years with the rise of the religious right and the sort of Reagan revolution.
You're fairly careful to untangle some of the terms early in the book, but for the listening audience, let's work out on are fundamentalists and evangelicals roughly equivalent, or is there a little more distinction between them?
Yes and no. So evangelical is the broader term, and we could talk about evangelicals in the 17th century or the 19th century, and it's sort of a large umbrella term that emphasizes or that describes people who put emphasis on the centrality of the Bible in the person of Jesus Christ and the necessity of individual salvation, so the idea of converting. And so it's very individualistic. It focuses on you and your personal relationship with God or with Jesus. Within that, then, there are many subgroups. And so the one that I focus on in this book is the rise of fundamentalism. And I talk about it really as a phenomenon of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And so these are folks who are much more radical, and they're the folks who have this particular belief that Jesus is coming soon, that the world is coming to an end, and that's what motivates them, and that's what defines them. And there are a number of other things. What they try to do is call Christians back to what they described as the fundamentals of Christianity, and so that's where the term arises, that they're calling us back to the fundamentals. But in fact, what they were espousing was a theology or a creed that was very much a product of its own time and its own place, much more so than the first century Christianity that they hoped they were preaching.
Interesting. So they interpreted what they were doing as a sign of the true will of Jesus Christ?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, all religions would do that. There's no point in following a religion if you don't think it's the truth. But certainly for them, they believed that humans had lost much of the truth of Christianity, especially through the early modern times, the medieval period, and that slowly Christians were rediscovering it through the Protestant Reformation, through the revivals of the 18th century, and then in their minds through this rise of this apocalyptic Christianity in the late 19th and early 20th century. So they believe that as we were moving towards the end of this world, as we were moving towards the end of this age, they were increasingly receiving more of the truth that Jesus wanted to share with them.
Matthew, when people look for key events in the rise of Christian fundamentalism, they tend to focus on things like the Scopes trial, and you say that historians exaggerated the importance of that trial.
Right, and I think the trial itself is very important. I don't think we've exaggerated its meaning. I think we just misunderstood what it did. In the issue of creation and evolutionism is extremely important and continues to be one, and Scopes is about that. The problem I have with the way we've traditionally understood Scopes is that historians have aligned Scopes with fundamentalism. And for fundamentalists, Scopes was a minor issue. Evolution was a minor issue at that point. It, in fact, becomes much more important for evangelicals in the 1970s and 1980s than it was for fundamentalists in the 1910s and 1920s. But what happened was during the Scopes trial, a number of prominent journalists, H.L. Mencken being the most famous, as well as the lead attorney for the ACLU, Clarence Darrow, one of the most famous attorneys in the nation, they used the term fundamentalist as a pejorative to sort of dismiss the ideas of anybody who disagreed with them on evolutionary theory. And so it was at that point that fundamentalism moves from a very narrow, very specific term to describe a relatively small religious group into a broad, general term to sort of stigmatize anybody whose beliefs seem anti-modern or out of touch with contemporary events or contemporary thinking.
How different was this rise of evangelicalism from the spiritualist boom of the middle 19th century or the earlier Great Awakenings in America?
It was similar to the earlier Great Awakenings. There was a focus on revival, a focus on conversion, a focus on trying to get right with God. The spiritualism movement of the 19th century was a little bit different in that it saw a very different kind of Jesus. It saw a Jesus who brought, health and healing, but they weren't so focused on traditional creeds and traditional Christian theology, while the fundamentalists believed that they were restoring true Christianity. And the fundamentalists were, it's a term that they use for themselves, but they were people who were members of Baptist churches, Presbyterian churches, Methodist churches, various Pentecostal and independent churches. And so, they were Baptist, Presbyterians, et cetera, but they were also within those denominations. They saw themselves as part of this fundamentalist movement.
All right, so still within the bounds of the more conservative or at least the more traditional longstanding churches?
Exactly, yeah. They very much were part of traditional American Protestantism.
Matthew Avery Sutton from 2015 talking about his book American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. He's got so much more to talk about. You'll hear the rest of the interview shortly. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Historian Matthew Avery Sutton teaches at Washington State University and takes a particular focus on religion in American life. His four published books are about that very subject, including American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. Matthew joined us in August of 2015, and we go back there now with the usual reminder. We did have callers join us the first time around, but we can't take any new calls today. Matthew, you cite the parable of Jesus and 10 pounds in the Bible. How was that a guide for fundamentalist Christians?
Yeah, in some ways that's the central parable for the book, in the sense that what we've wondered about, what historians and journalists have tried to make sense of, is for these conservative Christians, these fundamentalists and later evangelicals who believe that Jesus is coming soon, who believe we're moving towards the Battle of Armageddon and this great apocalypse, why do anything at all? Why not just, wait for Jesus? Why not bury your heads in the sand and, look forward to the second coming, when in fact they've done just the opposite? We know they've done the opposite. They've been involved in all kinds of moral reform movements, from prohibition to anti-abortion. They've also been very involved in partisan politics, it's especially with the Republican Party and the rise of the religious right. And so for me, the paradox, the question that I wanted to answer in this book is, how does it make sense that if you believe time is running out, Jesus is coming soon, and this apocalypse is inevitable, then why would you try to perfect society? Why would you try to reform society? And the good thing is, I don't have to answer that myself. They answer that question for us. They told us over and over again, we just haven't heard them. And their answer was this parable of the pounds, that Jesus had said he had entrusted his followers with certain gifts, with certain talents. He was going away for a while, and he was going to come back. And when he came back, he was going to hold them accountable for what they've done with those talents, with those gifts. And so for fundamentalist Christians, they believed not only that Jesus was coming back soon, but that when he comes back, he's coming back to judge both the righteous and the unrighteous, and so they had better prove themselves righteous. And so for them, this sort of amps up the anxiety, this amps up the motivation, this amps up the power and the emphasis for them that they need to live holy and righteous lives and be doing God's work so that when Jesus comes back, they can answer that they've done everything to the best of their ability to spread his word and to make the world a better place for him.
Which is a really important thing to consider when you're thinking about things like compromise and politics. I mean, if you think that you're compromising away your basic principles and you're trying to get right with God before he comes back and judges you, this is not an easy thing to do.
No, exactly. And so that's been one of the other questions I tried to answer in the book, is how is it that they have been, or why is it that they're so dogmatic, that they're so unwilling to, to sit down and to sort of give and take and participate in old-fashioned American, backroom politics? And the reason is because they're true believers. They really believe that God is going to hold them accountable. And when they win in terms of politics or on social issues, it's a great victory. But when they lose, it's a victory too, because it just shows that we're getting one step closer to the end times, one step closer to the return of Jesus Christ. And so they win by winning, they win by losing, but they don't ever win by compromising. That's the one thing you don't do.
Well, Matthew Avery Sutton, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange's book, American Apocalypse. Let's take some calls. Let's go to Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for doing this good work, Professor. I don't even know where to start, so I'll start here. The Republican Central Committee in Josephine County at one point was taken over in a kind of Night of the Long Knives sort of action. And I knew this because a dear friend was a committee chairperson, and the church ladies literally came in. Each of them had a note card. Each of them had a scripted role to play as the proceedings occurred. And by the end of the evening, the local Republican Central Committee was controlled by the religious right. They had stuffed it. I have not seen it in action, but I was one step away from it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very, very hard time with true believers. I'm an agnostic. There clearly was a historical Jesus. He was a radical. It's documented that he traveled across India into the Himalayas. There's some evidence and suggestions that he did not die on the cross, that had to do with a generation's earlier event that John the Baptist knew about, and there are strong suggestions that the historical Jesus lived till the age of 80 in Kashmir.
Hmm.
Most of the documentation of all of these sorts of activities were, of course, suppressed by the church. The writings are like that. When you start looking at the Gnostic fragments, you find that in fact Jesus probably was in the Himalayas during the missing years and came back, because what he's presenting are very, very similar to the thoughts and philosophies of that period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I won't go any further into it except to say that give credit to the Jews. They managed to keep their traditions and their histories as well as any oral tradition in history can, coming from Ur all the way down. But everything in the New Testament is just a politicized mishmash of nonsense.
Hmm, okay, strong words. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it, Matthew. Any thoughts?
Yeah, just sort of my role as historian is not to judge whether or not the beliefs are accurate or true or not, but to think about what they've done to motivate people. And we could make those kinds of discussions about any religion, whether it's beneficial or not beneficial. And obviously there's raging debates about these things. But what's interesting for me and what I try to do with my students is to just help them understand the worldview of folks who believe this, and to understand how they think and why they act the way they do. And so, you know, the car started with this issue of local politics in Oregon. And certainly that's a story that's, you know, repeated itself all over the country, because these religious activists have become very motivated and become very organized. And so part of what I'm trying to do is just explain why, to explain the thinking behind their actions, and to explain sort of the end game as well as where it's coming from.
All right, another call here from Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matthew Avery Sutton. His book is American Apocalypse.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
Many years ago, I was in a job that required that we listen to this guy preach to us every day before we had breakfast. And he would get up and talk about how he had a son 7 and a son 9, and he knew that they wouldn't live to adulthood before Jesus came back, which was why we needed to get right with Jesus immediately. And I can just imagine that today he's preaching, I have a grandson 7 and a grandson 9, and I'm sure that they will not live to adulthood before Jesus comes back, so you should get right with Jesus now.
All right, thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. So that raises the question, the broader question of the imminence, and of course several people have staked their reputations on Jesus coming back at a certain time, and he didn't. But for the folks who might not understand that this level of religious fervor, you want Jesus back, but it's also going to be a very wrenching sort of thing for society and a lot of individuals, isn't it?
Right. And so, yeah, it's going to be bad for the non-true believers. For the true believers, the idea is that they're going to be raptured out of this before the tribulation, before the rise of the Antichrist. And so they believe true Christians will essentially be taken off this earth, taken to heaven, and then they'll sort of wait out the seven-year period while the earth is controlled by the Antichrist, which is going to be this awful tribulation culminating in this horrific war. And so it is a very dark projection of what's going to happen. And so, again, for the evangelicals, this is all the more motivation to get right with God sooner rather than later, because you don't want to endure the tribulation. But on the caller's other point about, you know, preachers who say Jesus is coming back, you know, in before a certain amount of time, before their kids reach adulthood, one of the fun things for me in doing this book, and I say fun probably in an academic sense, I suppose most people probably wouldn't think this is fun, but it was fun for me, was to track these prophecies and to see folks who say these things over and over again. And every once in a while, they'll recognize they got it wrong, and then they'll acknowledge that, but most of the time they don't. And so the classic example in the book is Billy Graham, who in 1952 said he thought Jesus was coming back within 6 months, maybe a year at the most. And then in the 1960s, he says it again. He says, before this decade is over, Jesus is coming back. And then in the 1980s, he says, we're closer than ever. And then in 2010, he wrote a new book, a reissue of an old book, but he updated it for 2010, called Storm Warning, where once again, he said, we're closer to Jesus coming back than ever. And so for 60 years, we've had Billy Graham as the most powerful, most prominent, most important evangelical leader in the nation. And yet he's consistently said Jesus is coming back, and Jesus hasn't come back yet.
Fundamentalist Christianity, our topic on the Jefferson Exchange. Matthew Avery Sutton from Washington State University is the author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. So some of the historical figures in the movement, William Blackstone and Jesus is Coming. What led to his writing that book?
So William Blackstone was a real estate developer in Chicago, and he went to a Bible conference, or these series of Bible conferences often during the summer that people would go to in the late 19th century. Some of them just emphasized how to read your Bible. Some emphasized different issues of personal morality or holiness, but some emphasized prophecy. And he went to one of these things and began studying the Bible and sort of seeing it through new eyes. And what he began to believe was that the signs were beginning to appear that the Bible had laid out, and this is in the Old Testament books of Ezekiel and Daniel and the New Testament book of Revelation, as well as in Jesus' sermons in Matthew 24. And he believed that if you put together these signs, you could compile them all, and then they would give you a series of events that would tell you when you were getting very close to the second coming of Jesus. And so as he looked around at the world, as he saw it in the 1870s and 1880s, he believed that those signs were appearing more than ever, and so that motivated him to write this book, Jesus is Coming, and to put a lot of the money he had made in Chicago real estate into various Christian ministries, various Christian missions, to try to spread this gospel of Jesus' imminent second coming.
Well, and the things that he took as signs of the coming of Jesus, immigration, economic upheaval, fear of war, divisions within the United States, and you can see the staying power of all of those topics within the Christian fundamentalist movement.
Exactly, yeah. It's stuff that, on the one hand, you could apply to almost any generation, declining morality, you know, children disrespecting their elders. But then there's a handful that were very specific that seemed to be fulfilled in the 20th century. One of them was the return of Jews to Palestine, that Blackstone in the 1880s began saying, before Jesus comes back, we need the return of Jews to Palestine. And so he became an early Zionist and worked very closely with Jewish Zionist leaders in support of the return of Jews to Israel, and then later fundamentalists and evangelicals defended the creation of the State of Israel, and to this day are some of the staunchest supporters of Israel, because it fits into their theology, their prophetic beliefs, their sense that this is an inevitable step towards the second coming of Christ, is the return of Jews to Israel, and ultimately the restoration of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, which hasn't happened yet, but they're still anticipating that as well.
We already talked about the fact that evangelicals and more liberal Christians existed within the same houses of worship. But at some point, there must have been a backlash of some sort by the liberal Christians against you call the radical evangelicals.
Yeah, there was. It happened during World War One. One of the ironies is that the way we see politics today is very different than what it was in World War One. During World War One, Protestant liberals were the warmongers. They were the folks who were 100% gung-ho behind Woodrow Wilson and the idea of making the world safe for democracy. The fundamentalists were the ones who were the pacifists. They believed that wars were inevitable and that as God's people, they had no business waging war, that their job was to preach the imminent second coming of Christ and to get people as ready as possible for Jesus' return. And so it was that difference, which actually took on political ramifications, do you support the war or don't you support the war, that really drove a wedge between these fundamentalist Christians and these liberal Christians. And as the fundamentalists began growing in power and growing in influence, the liberal Christians became more and more troubled and more threatened. And so ultimately this exploded into this huge controversy in the 1920s and 30s that split the Methodist denomination, split the Presbyterian denomination, split the Baptist denomination. And in terms of the hierarchies and the positions of power, the liberals almost entirely won. They almost ran the table. They controlled the Baptist seminaries and the Baptist churches, the Presbyterians the same, Methodists the same. But so what that did was it drove these fundamentalists out, and so then they began a number of smaller denominations or independent Bible colleges or independent churches. Or they just developed new denominations, and so they're smaller Presbyterian offshoots or smaller Baptist denominations that represented or espoused these fundamentals of Christianity.
I gather from reading American Apocalypse that one of the things that the liberal Christians did with the fundamentalists was point out that you're not the first people to believe the apocalypse was coming that soon. What was the frequent response to that?
Right, and they did. And one of the things that the fundamentalists were very careful about was never to name dates. And so someone, whether it was William Blackstone or Billy Graham, would say Jesus is coming soon, but they would also cite Jesus' reference that you don't know the day or the hour. And so they would say, we can't tell you for sure. And so they were never one of those groups that actually, you know, gave us a day or an hour, as others in American history have. And so what that did was it kept a constant sense of anticipation, a constant sense of hopefulness, without allowing them to be branded as false prophets, because they never said for sure Jesus is coming on this day or this hour. And so really it was a genius theology for keeping people in church, for keeping people motivated, for keeping people anticipating the second coming, because it was always just around this corner, and if not this corner, it was always around the corner after that, but you never knew when it was going to happen.
All right, more questions for you. Let's go to John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matthew Avery Sutton, the author of American Apocalypse.
I have a lot of questions, but I'll try and limit it to this judgment part. I know a number of born-again Christians, if that's what they want to be called, and most of them are very nice, and I don't find that they're very judgmental. But some people are, and they're determined, once again, that you're going to be judged if you're not in the right church or something like that. And was this always the case in the old days? Is it worse now, or do you think it was worse back then? And once again, most of the folks I know are not judgmental, but some, and I'll give a typical example on gay marriage, are extremely judgmental. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, John.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, when you believe that you have a monopoly on absolute truth, it's going to foster some sense of judgment. And sometimes it's a positive judgment that you're truly have true compassion for people that you believe are going to hell, and so you want to do everything you can to try to share what you see as the good news with them, to try to get them saved. Sometimes it manifests itself on, you know, harsh and ugly judgments, protests at gay marriages, or, you know, back in the early 2000s and late 1990s, these protests at funerals of servicemen saying God was punishing America for gays, and et cetera, et cetera. But the other thing is, I think this is also just an issue of human nature. We also have liberals, you know, judging people for stepping into Walmart or feeding their kids Happy Meals at McDonald's. And so I think you can find judgment across the board. It's not necessarily a theological thing.
All right. Gene and Winston, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matthew Avery Sutton.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Gene.
Yes. Well, I have questions about fundamentalist belief in Genesis and in the Book of Revelation. In Genesis, do fundamentalists really believe that the stars were created after the earth? And my second question is, well, I can't go on with that, but then in Revelations, it seems to me very kind of pertinent. They talk about the mark of the beast, and it seems to me that kind of fits in with having chips implanted in people, and I kind of think that beast might be the whole world bureaucratic computer globalization network and AI and stuff that's kind of taking over. So I appreciate your program, and I'm listening to your answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Gene. Appreciate that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll start with the second part, the mark of the beast. So fundamentalists and modern evangelicals believe that one of the signs of Jesus' imminent coming is that when the Antichrist takes power, he's going to force everybody to bear his mark in order to participate in the economy. And so one of the things I do in the book is try to show how the mark of the beast has changed from generation to generation. And so Roosevelt's NRA, the National Recovery Administration, in the 1930s, there was a symbol to participate in the NRA, which was the Blue Eagle. And so in the 1930s, fundamentalists wondered if the Blue Eagle was setting the stage for the rise of the Antichrist and the Mark of the Beast. Later on, it became the Visa. It was, maybe Visa was the Mark of the Beast. Then it was, even some thought it was Ronald Wilson Reagan. There are six letters in each of his names, 666. And so it's something that has created lots of enduring fascination for fundamentalists and evangelicals.
We'll pick up the Genesis reference after a break. Matthew Avery Sutton visited in August 2015 to talk about American Apocalypse, a history of modern evangelicalism. You'll hear the rest of the interview here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We tend to associate the rise of religion in American public life with the last quarter or so of the 20th century, but it goes back much further than that. Historian Matthew Avery Sutton makes that clear in his book, American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. The interview is from 3 years ago, so we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Gene and Winston had a two-part question. We already talked about the Mark of the Beast and some of the recent views on that, but she also talked about the book of Genesis and whether people actually believe that the stars were created after the earth. In general, does the fundamentalist movement pay much attention to the Old Testament as much as the New?
Oh, they do, especially for understanding prophecy, because much of it comes out of the Old Testament, and particularly the books of Daniel and Ezekiel. But on the issue of Genesis, the interesting thing that I found is up until the end of World War I, fundamentalists were not that worried about the age of the earth. Many of them believed that humans were made in the image of God, so they weren't the product of some kind of survival of the fittest or natural selection. But other than that, they were more than willing to embrace, or at least to entertain, ideas that the earth was perhaps older than initially thought, and perhaps that God had used the evolutionary process. But what happens during World War I is a number of Americans, as well as Germans, America's enemy during the war, they begin to use Darwinian ideas of natural selection and survival of the fittest and apply it to society. And they use it to justify war, to justify genocide, to justify a lot of social engineering of trying to purge the gene pool. And so once they begin to see some of these really dark and negative social ramifications of evolutionary ideas, that's when they become increasingly skeptical of it. And so really beginning around the end of World War I is when they became more staunch anti-evolutionists, and then that, of course, has remained to this day.
And back to the idea of looking for the mark of the beast, because that's what the Antichrist would require society to bear. It seems, though, that if you're looking for signs, you interpret the things you see as signs. So there have been quite a few interpretations through the years of people think, well, you know, the whole thing about Obama being the Antichrist, for example.
Right, exactly. And so they see these things as precursors. They believe that ultimately the Antichrist is going to take power through a one-world government, and so they're very skeptical, very suspicious of the United Nations. They're very suspicious of anything that seems to compromise American power. And they're also very skeptical of the growing power of the state, of the American federal government. And so beginning with the rise of Franklin Roosevelt and New Deal liberalism all the way to the present, anytime the federal government takes powers that it had not previously held, they feel like this is a step towards Antichrist rule. This is a step in the wrong direction. It's a step of ultimately ceding your Christian liberties and your Christian rights to what is going to ultimately pave the way for the Antichrist.
Okay, a few more calls here. Al in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matthew Sutton, the author of American Apocalypse.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, you know, I have seen a program a few years back on PBS, and they speaks of Christian Zionists, and they cited example of Jim Hagee and also Pat Robertson, and how their support for the expelling of the Palestinians of whatever left for them, which is a part of the West Bank. And also, I recall when Bush came in his plan for a two-state solution, before his re-election in the spring of 2004, when Sharon came to this country with his 14-point, questions about Bush's plan for the two-state solution, he met first with Ralph Reed before he met with Bush, I think as a way to, as a pressure on George W.
Mm-hmm, right.
So I would like to see how the effect of Christian Zionists, as they call themselves, on the killing of any peace plan and their support as well for the Israeli lobby. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Excellent question, Alan. Very much important to today's discussion. So Ralph Reed was the person that Ariel Sharon met with first, from what Al is telling us?
Yeah, and Reed was savvy. We talked earlier about evangelicals' tendency not to compromise. That's not true with Reed. Reed was somebody who recognized you could have incremental change. You would want to win things one step at a time. And so he was willing to play ball with those who disagreed with him or that he disagreed with. But the larger question of evangelical Zionism is an important one. Evangelicals have been one of the strongest pro-Israel lobbies in the U.S., second only to American Jewish lobbies for Israel. And so the Jewish government knows this. The Jewish government has courted them extensively. And so it's sort of a bizarre relationship because evangelicals are supporting Israel, believing that's going to be the battleground for this, this huge war of Armageddon. But at the same time, Jewish leaders, they, even though they understand this theology, they recognize that evangelical support is very useful to them. So essentially it's a strange relationship where both groups are using the other for very different reasons, but to the same end, which is to have a powerful, strong Israel.
Is there any inconsistent belief on the Christian right about whether they should make peace at a two-state solution?
That was actually a real controversy at the time. The most evangelicals and fundamentalists would say no, that the land that God has given to the Jews laid out in the Old Testament is the land that God wants them to occupy today. And so they would say there should be no compromise. Now, there have been a few, though, like Ralph Reed, who did say, well, let's take things one step at a time. That ultimately, God may want to return all of this land to the Jews, but we'll take half a glass now or half a loaf now and take the second half later.
All right, Matthew, I want to get in some of the big names of the rise of the fundamentalist movement. Billy Sunday, now there's a name and a story. Tell us a bit about him.
Yeah, he was a baseball player turned evangelist whose heyday was in the 1910s. And he would have these huge revivals both in rural areas as well as in cities in New York and in Chicago. And just filling out, he was essentially the early Billy Graham. And he just blasted people for immorality. He was a big believer in prohibition. But he also was somebody who believed Jesus was going to return soon. And so he's just a colorful, charismatic character. He was not well-educated. He used slang. He used at the time what would have been seen as vulgar language. And that just made him all the more popular.
Interesting. More to talk about with about him and some of the other people in just a moment. Leo and Eugene, you're up. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matthew Avery Sutton.
Matthew Avery Sutton, good morning. And Jeff, good morning.
Hi.
Morning.
I just have three quick comments. I think regarding the discussion at hand, it's a whole new world with the rise of computers and smarties in the last 10, 15 years. For example, Bush was president, you would bring up Bush's The Antichrist, so many hundreds of thousands of websites. Same today with Obama. Well, my two comments to explain my situation are two quotes from the 19th century. I think it was the century of enlightenment. The first one is, I don't know the author. It says, there is no absurdity so palpable but that it may be firmly planted in the human head if you only begin to inculcate it before the age of five by constantly repeating it with a great air of solemnity. Now, my upbringing was from a woman born in Ireland deep into the Catholic religion. Mm-hmm. Okay, the last quote and last comment is, the dreams of childhood, its airy fables, its graceful, beautiful, humane, impossible adornments of the world beyond, so good to be believed in once, so good to be remembered when outgrown.
All right. Thanks for that, Leo. Appreciate that. So obviously some thoughts there about his own experience with religion. Let's go on to Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Howdy. The main problem with fundamentalists, whether they be Christian, Christian, Islamic, Jewish, Hindu, is that they confuse belief with reality and think they got a corner on the whole belief market and just will not give up their, or, you know, even tolerate another mythology to theirs. Bertrand Russell wrote a whole piece on this back when he was writing. And just the level of intolerance of these people, I think, should be addressed. Their inability to tolerate anything except, you know, their own corner of mythology.
All right. Thanks for that, Steve. Appreciate it. Which so let me bring this along to another figure that you bring up in the book, because there was somebody who did criticize the rise of fundamentalism. That was Harry Emerson Fosdick, who gave a sermon about fundamentalism, which I think was along the lines of what Steve is saying.
Yeah, there were a number of important Protestant liberals, important Protestant leaders, who criticized fundamentalism, and they saw it as intolerant, and certainly in many ways it was. But for me, the irony here is the lack of tolerance that we often show for people who have a belief in that teaches intolerance. So, for example, fundamentalists believe they have the absolute truth. Well, I'm tolerant enough to be comfortable with that. That doesn't threaten me. I don't think they're right, but that's okay. And I think it's just, you know, we have room in the United States for people who want to believe that they have a monopoly on truth. There's no problem with that, I don't think.
All right. So what was the response from to the sermon that Harry Emerson Fosdick gave?
It was a popular sermon. It was reprinted. It was spread around the country. And so in many ways, it became sort of this galvanizing event that really exaggerated or emphasized the growing divide between fundamentalists and more mainstream Protestant liberals that helped lead to this controversy in the 1920s and 30s and this splitting of churches.
And then there were certainly some responses from the other side from people who had some names. Amy Semple McPherson, for example, had a rather fiery response, I think, to the likes of Harry Emerson Fosdick.
She did. She's a great character. I actually did my first book on Amy Semple McPherson, and she was a preacher in Los Angeles in the 1920s and 30s, one of the few women who took on a leadership role in fundamentalism, because most fundamentalists believe women shouldn't preach. She did it anyway. But she criticized Fosdick, and one of the things that made her famous was in Los Angeles, she would stage these pageants, these dramatic illustrated sermons, and she would use all the tricks and tools and talents of Hollywood to create these elaborate sets and have professional actors and professional costumes. And so she did a sermon about the liberal professors, and Fosdick was one of the ones she criticized, and she sort of argued that they were diluting Christianity and that she was calling Christians back to true, original, essential Christianity.
Interesting, the criticism of liberal professor, because we hear that a lot these days, particularly from the Christian right, about how the minds are being polluted at American universities by liberal professors.
Yeah, and obviously as a professor in a public university, I'm particularly sensitive to that critique. The thing I tried to do and what I tried to do in this book was just to lay out the evidence and allow readers, and this is the same thing I do in my classes with my students, allow them to come to their own conclusions. And I try to be fair. I try to, you know, write in a way that evangelicals can see themselves in the book. And the thing that surprised me is how well received the book has been on evangelical blogs and on evangelical websites, and that they, you know, they have used it as a tool for reflection and for thinking about places where they've made mistakes. I also talk a lot about the civil rights movement and how evangelicals ended up on the wrong side of civil rights. And so they found it to be very useful and very informative for them, and that was certainly not something I anticipated when I wrote the book.
Which is a point we haven't even covered yet, is the fact that there was a distinct racial component to this. I mean, in terms of thinking that, you know, we're the ones who are gaining the Lord's favor, but not the ones who aren't white like us.
Exactly. Yeah, that African-Americans were intentionally and explicitly excluded from the fundamentalist movement really up until the 1970s. And then at that point, evangelicals began to realize, you know, how horrific their treatment of African-Americans had been and other ethnic minorities. And they really did, many of them, not all of them, but many of them began to repent of that and ask for forgiveness. And it, you know, continues to be a work in progress. But one of the interesting things I found in the book was just how explicitly white fundamentalism was. There really weren't African-American fundamentalists in the 20s and 30s and 40s, because they weren't allowed to be fundamentalists. They weren't included in the networks or admitted into the Bible colleges or invited to the prophecy conferences.
The arrival of Judgment Day, the rapture, the second coming, I mean, a couple different terms to roll in here, but I'm unclear from what you write in the book about whether some fundamentalists thought they could hasten the return of Jesus, or whether Jesus was simply coming on his own clock.
Yeah, and they're unclear, so that's why. And it's not that they're unclear, but they disagree. So some of them believe that it's inevitable, it is set in stone, Jesus is coming back. We just don't know the day or the hour, but God does. Others believe they can hasten it or slow it down, and so that adds even more incentive for trying to prepare the world for Jesus' second coming or to slow it down so you can get more people saved before Jesus comes back. But there's disagreement on this particular point throughout the last 150 years, and it's something that they argue about, they discuss, they debate, they go back and forth on this question.
And Matthew, I understand the book you're working on next is about FDR mobilizing an army of faith during the Second World War.
Yeah, religion and espionage in World War II. Missionaries and priests who became spies because they knew language, they knew contexts, they knew cultures. They became great sources of information for the American military.
Wow, sounds wild and fun, and I hope we get to talk to you about that book when it comes out.
I would love to.
All right, this book is called American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. Matthew Avery Sutton wrote it and joined us on The Exchange. Matt, thanks.
Thank you so much, Jeff.